Aggressive, dominant, excellent, adult onset, prenatal, infertility, pediatrics, cancer, cardiac, neuro. Welcome to Gene Therapy with Nick Charles.
Hello, and welcome back. My name is Nick Charles, and this is Gene Therapy. Now, friends, life in quarantine has been a little bit crazy, let's just say that. And this episode was like a breath of fresh air because I got to have a very lovely conversation with one of my favorite humans in the world, Casey Marks. And Casey Marks happens to be in her second year of genetic counseling graduate school. She will be graduating very soon. She will, fingers crossed, have a job very soon. And we are giving you what you want and finally answering all the questions that I've gotten about how to become a genetic counselor and what does the day-to-day of a genetic counselor look like. And we had a lovely time having this conversation. It actually ended up lasting a little bit over 2 hours. So what I have done is split up our convo into two separate parts. The first will be this episode, and then I will be releasing the second part of our conversation as episode 4. So I think that is that for now. Please enjoy. Hope everyone is staying safe and happy and hydrated. What else? I don't know. I guess that's it. So we will start out by hearing a word from our sponsor, and then we will jump into part one of our conversation with Casey Marks about how to become a genetic counselor.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
Oh, I'm good. It's early on Sunday, so I don't need to... oh my goodness, this worked. I'm very excited. I was like, I don't know if this is going to work or not, but here we are. So anyway, so this is Gene Therapy, episode 3. And as I had said, I was going to have one of my favorite humans on, Casey Marks.
And, oh, thank you.
And she is currently a grad student. So is it still Arcadia or is it something else now?
So we are technically the last graduating class from Arcadia. The current class that are in their first year are technically the University of Pennsylvania now.
Okay, gotcha. All right, I knew it had changed, but yeah. So as I had promised, because there was a lot of questions about, how do I become a genetic counselor? What do I do if I'm an undergrad, things like that. I was like, well, this is perfect because we're all stuck in our houses because of Miss Corona. And
I definitely don't recommend doing grad school during a pandemic. That's the first tip.
Because Arthur's in grad school too. And I feel like you're both very similar in that you enjoy interacting with other people.
Yeah.
And he's going insane. And I'm like, oh, whatever, I'll read a book, I'll play a video game, I'm fine. To give some background here, Casey and I have been friends for what, like 5 years now? 5, 6 years? I don't even know.
When did you start at Recombine? In
2014.
2014, yeah.
I think you started like a couple months before me.
Yeah, I started end of June.
Yeah, so Casey and I met working for Recombine, which at the time was a startup genetic testing company offering carrier screening. And it was like us and council. And we were like weird rivals. And it was interesting coming from a clinical position and then being like, oh, I work for like a company that like offers products now. We make money off of it. But I feel like from the moment we met in the first New York office, we were like, girl, we're going to be friends because we could look at each other from across our like little IKEA desks. And like we shared that like, yeah, that like weird like glance of like when somebody said something stupid.
Oh yeah, like did she really just say that?
All the time. So I obviously, as I've kind of talked about before in previous episodes, was going into working at Recombine, already being a genetic counselor, but Casey came to Recombine not being a genetic counselor yet. And now she's about to be a full-fledged genetic counselor. We went through a lot of changes at Recombine. We eventually became a part of Cooper Genomics, Cooper Surgical, which is now, but Casey is no longer an employee of Cooper Surgical because she's in grad school. So,
right, among other reasons.
Among other reasons. So, so in saying that, I just thought, what better way to talk about how to become a genetic counselor than with somebody who not only do I know will give good advice, but is also about to become like a genetic counselor, like for reals. So,
yeah.
Anywho, I have a short list of questions for you. Hopefully none of them will be too intense since it is 9 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday. I guess we'll just get into it. So,
all right.
Something that I've touched upon before is like, oh my God, I feel like a valuable right now. It's too early. My brain is still catching up to my everything else. So, especially for like me and individuals who have been genetic counselors, even, you know, previously prior to like my quote unquote generation, like a lot of the people that we both worked with at Recombine and Cooper Genomics and Cooper Surgical and other places as well, like, I don't want to say women, but it's mostly women. but genetic counselors, like in their 40s and their 50s, like, it still is interesting to me, like how they came across the career, like how did they know this was an option? Because even for myself, I didn't really learn about it until I just by happenstance came across somebody, not even in my own life, but in my mom's life, who had a daughter who was becoming a genetic counselor. And I was like, oh, I should look into that. So first question is, how did you discover genetic counseling?
Yeah, I think I was kind of different in that I found it on my own through research, where a lot of people, they know someone or their mom knows someone, or maybe them or someone in their family actually went to go see a genetic counselor.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they got into it. But before I even went to undergrad, I knew that I didn't want to go to medical school. Not for me. But I knew that I wanted to still be somewhat patient facing.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just Googling like what to do with a biology degree that isn't med school.
Yeah. I mean, that's very much, it sounds very familiar to me, but yours was like very much more like, let's be proactive about it. And mine was like, I know I don't want to go to grad. I know I don't want to go to med school, but like now what do I do with this like bachelor's degree that I'm almost done getting?
Yeah.
And am I stuck with it forever now? But the other funny thing is like, especially like, you know, this as well, because one of our colleagues, Jenna Miller, like, I think even some other people that we work with too, there are so many people who learned about genetic counseling through a parent that is a speech pathologist.
Yeah.
I don't know what that's about, but my mom's a speech pathologist. Jenna's mom, our colleague, is a speech pathologist. I feel like there's somebody else on the genetic counseling team at Cooper Genomics who has a parent who's a speech pathologist or somebody they know that is one. It's just like one of those weird things.
Yeah. And I mean, it makes sense. All these kind of healthcare positions that are different therapies that individuals might get if they have also seen genetic counseling. So they all work together, but.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. That's how I heard about it. I just Googled.
Well, good for you. Cause I don't know. That's definitely not something I was thinking about, in my late teens, early 20s. I was like thinking about video games and egg sandwiches at the cafeteria because they were really good. Anyway.
Yeah, that's another thing that I'm going to say is different about our paths. They did not involve egg sandwiches for me.
That is true. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's just due to your dietary restrictions.
Yeah. Also, there was no theater.
This is also true. Even though you would get along with theater children very well because, because you're like you're a real person. Like I'm half of a real person. Like I'd rather be an introvert in my apartment doing whatever I want than actually go outside. But like I force myself to, because I have to. Number two, why do you want to become a genetic counselor?
I've had to answer this question so many times because I'm in the midst of interviewing for jobs right now. So right. I've got my answer down.
Oh, good.
I think that I really like talking to people. It's just part of my personality. And the other big thing I love is educating people, whether that's like on the internet chat rooms or like in real life, educating people and telling them anything and everything about genetics and helping them to understand and really take action for their own medical care. And it was something that I saw was lacking. I think there's like a huge disconnect between doctors and their patients, and they need someone to help like dumb it down a bit. And then there's just so much that doctors aren't taught in med school when it comes to genetics. So
oh yes,
I like the idea of like one-upping the doctors.
I can tell you from firsthand experience that that's really fun. Again, going back to our colleague Jenna Miller, when I first started clinical work at Rutgers, Jenna was actually my first intern. Because she was the year, I was second year when she was first year at Sarah Lawrence. So she ended up being my intern. But she started literally like the day after I started my job. So I was like, girl, I have no idea what I'm doing. So we're going to learn everything together. But one of the best things was sitting the med students down that were also rotating with me and like teaching them all these things that they had no idea about.
And like the basics.
Yeah. And they would be like, oh, dang. Like, cool. So you keep talking and I'll sit here. And that was always really fun because even some of the med students were like, I'm going to be a doctor. Like, who do you think you are?
Yeah, that's day one at med school. That happened.
Basically. And I'm sure like you have some friends who are in the midst of becoming doctors or are doctors as well. But I have a lot of friends who are now doctors, whether like I have a friend who's anesthesiologist now. I have friends who work in like neurology, and my old roommate from college, Chris. Hey, Chris, he's a pediatrician. And like I remember when they were still in med school and I was already like done with schooling and like already having a job, and I thought I was really like awesome and like haha, look at me, I make money. We would like talk about very common things like cystic fibrosis, or like they'd be like, oh, you know, I have this patient and like there's something weird with their skull or their face or whatever, and I would be like, oh yeah, it's blah blah blah. Mm-hmm. And they would be like, I had to look that up and then I couldn't find it, and then, you know, how do you know that? And I'm like, oh, well, you know, because I'm a genetic counselor and we have superpowers, duh.
Exactly.
But like basically,
like, sometimes it's, I feel like a witch.
No, for reals though, because we learn such specific things in school.
Yeah.
Because we have to. And as I've mentioned before, I hated oh my God, what the heck is it called? All the metabolic diseases.
Yeah.
Like any of that stuff is probably gone from my brain that I had to learn for all those tests. Like it was definitely a mind dump.
I think it's because a lot of it is like not genetics. It's like the biochemical stuff.
Well, right. So that stuff is the actual medical things, like that a doctor who is caring for that patient should know. But it is really crazy sometimes. Like there are some doctors who are treating patients with, you know, X, Y, or Z syndrome, and they don't actually even know if it's recessive or dominant. And ultimately that may not affect the doctor's treatment for the patient, but it's certainly pertinent information that they should probably know.
Yeah. I've come across doctors who are like, oh, don't worry. There are some kinds of breast cancer syndromes that are X-linked. And I was like,
girl, where? No, they
I was like, excuse me. God.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it can be crazy sometimes. And that was also the other favorite thing about the med students, being a genetic counselor in a teaching hospital, learning hospital, teaching hospital. I forget which one is the term. It doesn't matter.
Well, some people teach, some people learn. That's the point, right?
So, it's same thing. Anyway, this is already like perfect first guest, because you're just gonna yes and me, and it's gonna be great. They would say something and I would be like, no, that's not it. I remember there was a patient, because it was a high risk OB center that I was in, and we got a lot of birth defects. And I remember there being, I think it might have been like an omphalocele or something.
Oh my God. I like literally am thinking of a patient that I had in my last rotation, and I hope it's the same exact thing that you're about to say.
Who knows? It might be. But they were talking about like, oh, well, you know, if it's an omphalocele, then it's got to be like, then it's got to be, like the mom must have blah 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 disease, and like it was really random, and it was like it feels like you just went into like genetic home reference or something and pulled a random card, because number one, it was an omphalocele. So for those who don't know what that is, I'm just going to keep saying the word omphalocele. but it's a growth defect for the baby, where there's, you know, some portion of the intestines outside of the body, like in a sac, and it might be covered in skin, it might not be, and it can cause some significant issues, because if it's not covered, then that intestine can start to basically die before the baby's even born. But of course, there's also lots of complications when you're trying to birth a baby with intestines not in the right place. It's kind of like spina bifida, but on the opposite side of the body. Mm-hmm. But yeah, he was just, it was, of course, it was a man. And he was just like, yeah, the mom. Oh, I remember now. He was like, the mom must have DeGeorge syndrome.
Oh.
And they passed it down. And I remember looking at him and being like, do you know what DeGeorge syndrome is? And he was like, yeah, you know, it's a genetic disease, and it can manifest in lots of different ways, and all the different people that have it in a family. And I was like, okay, but DeGeorge syndrome is a very specific thing. And it has like 10 different names, and it has nothing to do with omphalocele. Like, there are some chromosome abnormalities, for the audience out there, that you can see omphalocele or spina bifida with included. But those are typically not very, like, red flag markers for those chromosome abnormalities. They're things that can be associated with, but typically things like spina bifida, omphalocele, anything that, you know, might have to do with the growth of the main body cavity of the baby, especially during, like, the development of the spine and things like that, usually has to do with the lack of folic acid in mom's diet. And folic acid is very important in the development of the baby structurally. So this guy was just way off base. And then I remember, like, showing him exactly what an omphalocele was as well, because he hadn't, like, been sitting in on the ultrasound and stuff like that. And he was like, oh, I thought an omphalocele was, like, a kind of intellectual disability. And I was like, okay, well, that's not great. But also, it still doesn't make sense with what you had said.
That's not even, like, in the same realm.
Yeah, so then we had to, like, have this whole discussion about, like, what's a chromosome abnormality? And what's, like, what's a fetal malformation? And what could that mean? And how is it related to things? And how is it not? Because a baby growing is a very complicated process. So things can go wrong. And it's not, like, all that out of the realm of possibility to happen, because you're literally growing a human inside of yourself. The other thing about working in prenatal with male med students was, like, they were always like, I know all the things. And it's like, you will never be pregnant, so you definitely don't know all the things about making a baby. You know how a baby's made, but you don't know what it's like to carry a baby.
I feel like all the guys that go through genetic counseling programs, like, for, you know, 95% of their education, we talk about, like, all the things that could go wrong during pregnancy and development, and, like, all the things that could happen that could kill you while you're pregnant, or, like, fun things that could happen while you're pregnant, like just some, like, movement disorders or, you know, diabetes and things that you didn't have going on with you beforehand. And the guys are kind of floating through, like, cool, nothing happens to me. Cool, cool, cool.
Well, right. And I've touched upon this before as well. Like, that's why I was thinking to myself, I can't do prenatal counseling. Like, no woman's ever going to look at me and be like, I will trust his opinion, because he will never be pregnant.
I might not either, but I got the part.
That's true. Yeah. Like, you, and honestly, that's kind of after realizing, like, oh no, I like the prenatal stuff. Like, this is my jam. Like, then I kind of was like, all right, well, there's ways to talk about this. Like, you can preface by saying, like, I clearly don't know exactly what, like, an amniocentesis feels like, or I clearly don't know what it feels like for a baby to be kicking, or blah, 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 blah. But, like, here's what I do know, and et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, so med students, really, really interesting. But anyway, what was your story about omphalocele?
I was also at a high risk center, and I was actually in the middle of watching a fetal surgery for a spina bifida repair, and it was amazing, the coolest thing I've ever seen in my life. But there was a med student there, or a fellow, something. She wasn't quite practicing yet, and she asked me about a patient we had seen earlier in the day who had an omphalocele, and was asking why, like, what genetic tests they were doing for the mom. And I said, well, first, like, they're testing the baby. They did an amnio and they're testing the baby's DNA, not mom's DNA. And she was like, oh, and I was like, that's what an amnio is.
Oh.
And I was trying to explain to her that Beckwith-Wiedemann is, like, the number one thing you think of with omphalocele. I think, like, a third of omphalocele cases are actually Beckwith. And talking about that, and she, like, her, like, jaw was wide open. Like, I was getting words she had never heard before.
Well, right. Like, and things that we say all the time, like things that are, like, more common than anyone would think. Like, even, I remember I remember a lot of med students being familiar with the concept of Turner syndrome or 45X when a woman only has one X chromosome, but like they had no idea like the percentage of pregnancies that have Turner syndrome that end up in, you know, a demise, or that there was even anything serious related with that condition, you know, in terms of heart issues, or, oh, well, there's this, you know, huge cystic hygroma. We have to go through the list of all the potentials, and Turner syndrome is a high one on the list. Yeah. And we're like, oh, I thought that all the sex chromosome abnormalities were just like you had problems having babies, or something like things like that, or just like, I can't think of a condition right now that like we see a lot necessarily. Like Fragile X syndrome, most med students know about, but then the double-edged sword there is they think everything is Fragile X syndrome.
Right, where we could look at a family history and be like, it's definitely not that. They would be like, oh, yeah, it's that.
And they're like, why? And it's like, well, this is a girl. not that a girl can't have Fragile X syndrome, but more likely than not, it's not that if it's a girl. And for the audience who may not know, that is because Fragile X syndrome is an X-linked condition. So the vast majority of individuals who actually have the condition are male. But I definitely also plan on doing a little episode on Fragile X syndrome itself, because it's a very complicated but very interesting disease that is not just like you have a mutation, like it's a mutation, but it's an expansion of a certain part of a gene, and it's a whole thing. But like, just like how Down syndrome became a blanket term for a lot of chromosome abnormalities because that was the hot button topic one, Fragile X syndrome kind of became the hot button topic for all types of autism and intellectual disability, especially like 5-10 years ago when we were just learning a lot about these very specific conditions that cause certain types of intellectual disability. But, you know, again, intellectual disability we could talk about for like 10 hours. Oh, yeah. And there's 10 billion diseases that are genetic or not genetic that can be involved in it, but then there's also environmental and you know, upbringing factors and blah 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 blah, nature versus nurture and all the things. So let's not even go there. But bottom line is med students are great, but also they think they know everything, but they kind of know nothing. And that's what makes them really entertaining for the genetic counselors.
Yeah. And I think that like as a genetic counselor or a genetic counseling student, when you encounter med students, talk to them and don't be afraid to show off a little bit, because I think that will make better doctors and they'll rely more on genetic counselors in the future.
Yeah. And I will say, I think that every place that I've worked, I've felt really great about the doctors that I've worked with, because they do understand the necessity of genetic counseling, and that we are valuable individuals in a care team because we are so specialized. Mm-hmm. And we can take our skills and extrapolate them to other things as well, like just explaining something in very layman terms to a patient, or a lot of times the genetic counselor is the best person to be doing the direct communication with a interpreter on a phone when there's a language barrier, because we can take whatever we're talking about and break it down into like manageable sentences for the interpreter, instead of the doctor saying like 3 paragraphs.
Oh, yeah.
And then the interpreter being like, okay, hold up, we need to go back to the beginning because I have no idea what's going on. So yeah, no, and I also think that as much as it's like a funny ha-ha thing, also like Casey said, it almost challenge the med students, because it will empower you to make you realize like that what you do and the skills and the knowledge base that you have make you special and make you valuable. And I mean, it's easy to say that, but it's also really easy to back up given the job market for genetic counselors right now. Like, we're still in high demand. And I will say, when I started grad school, I was just doing it because I wanted to. Like, this is what I wanted to do with my life. But then, like, halfway through my graduate school was when, like, the job boom for genetic counselors happened. And people started realizing, like, oh, you is important. You is special.
Yeah,
you know,
I think whatever. That, you know, we do such a specific job and we fill this niche, and people should really feel like they're going into a profession that's so incredibly needed. Doctors can pretend all day, and you know, some of them are great and have a lot of education in genetics, but they're mm-hmm. focused on the patient care and drug interactions and, you know, treatments for their patient to get better. And we're really there to find out what's causing this all in the first place and to help them come up with a better plan for their patients. So it there's not a whole lot of overlap. And I think the services that genetic counselors provide are really important and specialized.
Yeah, no. And I think that all genetic counselors can have pride in that specifically. You know, I think that, and even our national governing body, the NSGC, like, in the last couple of years has done a very good job in reiterating to us, like, we are important. You know, we have valuable and very specific skills that are very beneficial to the patient. And we should push for, you know, better salaries and, you know, all the things. And I think we're finally starting to get a lot more traction than we used to, because especially with the boom of direct-to-consumer testing, everybody started, you know, clamoring for someone to explain these results to them, because they got, you know, the whole supreme package mm-hmm. deal and whatever. But then there's, like, all these reports that say all these potentially scary things, and then it's like, well, what does this mean, and who can tell me what it means? But also, going back to what you were saying about, you know, there's not much of an overlap with the doctors doing in their session and in our session. I think that's very true. And I think one of the other things that is very valuable for genetic counseling for the patient is we can give the patient the room they need to actually process information. And a lot of times, especially in, like, you know, high throughput centers, the patient might be coming in for their checkup with the doctor, and then in a half an hour, they have a session with you, and they're like, boom, 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 like, one-stop mm-hmm. shop in a day. And they might be coming into your office, or, you know, maybe you don't have an office, maybe it's in the middle of the clinic somewhere, but they're coming from talking with a doctor and their head's already spinning because the doctor was like, you're AMA and da 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 da, and you need this test and that test, and we're taking 18 tubes of your blood and da 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 da. And they're like, oh my God, what just happened? I have no idea. And, you know, we're the ones that can say, all right, well, this is why this was taken. This is what you were talking about with the doctor. This is, you know, what the ultrasound showed. This is why the ultrasound was done, blah, 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 blah. And then saying, you know, and putting all that together for the patient, this is the overall goal. And ultimately, when a patient is coming into any doctor, what they're looking for is a solution, is for a goal, is for how can you help me? And I think that even just like the organizing of a care plan falls on a genetic counselor a lot sometimes, regardless of where you work in the grander landscape of things. Like we talked about last week, whether it be cancer or cardio or, you know, peds or prenatal. As soon as a patient realizes like you're on their level and you are willing to discuss in their terms with them what the heck is going on, that's when all the questions are going to come out. But the good thing is that a genetic counselor will have the skill set and the knowledge and the training to, you know, 98% of the time, I would say, give them all the answers.
Yeah, they need. And I've always described it as like kind of a breath of fresh air for a patient. Like they are given the chance to just like breathe and absorb. And sit there in an awkward silence for 30 minutes if you want me to. And then, you know, slowly ask, what do you want to get out of this session? That's, you know, what we're taught as genetic counselors, to really ask the patient what they want to get out of their meeting with the genetic counselor. And I think that's something that doctors really, really don't do. They have their agenda and what they think is best for the patient. And we really try to get that input. And so, you know, everyone's on the same page.
Yeah. No, I think, you know, I think that's a really good way to put it, because I think the doctor does a lot of the data dump and then we kind of do the processing. But I think that, like, thinking of it like as the breath of fresh air, like literally a lot of times you will see a patient after you're done with them, like leave the room and their face is bright again, or like literally like maybe they were real, like their body language was really tense. And then as the session goes on, you literally see them, you know, relaxing. And then they're like, oh, like that's what that was for. And, oh, okay. That makes sense now. Like that is number one, very satisfying for a genetic counselor, because typically we're all type A personalities. but also like you're the one that the patient's going to remember. And if they have a follow-up question, you're likely the one that's going to get the call or the email, because you're the one that's really creating that bridge of trust a lot of the times. And I always felt like that was really satisfying and super cool.
We all like to be liked.
You know, I don't really, we all like to be liked. And again, like I don't get to speak to patients very often anymore, unless it's like for a bad reason. but like, even still, like I can equate that to the really tough patient that happens like once a week, where they're immediately on guard. They're coming into your office. They're like, why am I here? You're going to tell me I need an abortion, blah, 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 because they just, they don't have information, but they know what they've heard. And those are typically the patients that, as long as you do everything by the book, like you normally do, but you bend and, I was going to say bend and snap, like Legally Blonde. Oh my God.
Hopefully you don't snap. Bend and, like just before
hopefully
snapping.
You don't snap. Yeah, you bend, but you also tailor to the patient and their questions.
We need like a juicy version of bend and snap.
Yeah, the bend and don't snap. The bend and...
Bend and adapt.
CRISPR. I don't know. The bend and adapt. That at least, that makes more sense. But yeah, so if you get through to that patient...
Bend and CRISPR.
I don't know. Oh God. All right. So yeah, but you know, that patient, like if you get through to them and they leave feeling empowered and like they know what's going on, like they should, because that's our job. That's the patient that is usually the one that becomes your best friend, because you completely changed their outlook and their opinion on what the heck that they were coming into. So that's always fun too. But it's a really good example of like in an hour, the journey you can take a patient on, because ultimately you are going through a lot of information and apparently you're, you're bending and CRISPRing.
That's like a really, like, what was that? Like a 20 minute way of saying why I wanted to be a genetic counselor, but we came full circle. Like
that's
it's
totally
because
fine.
You want to be able to,
to
talk to the patient on a real level and let them leave feeling empowered and like they have control of their life again after what may have been like a difficult journey.
Yes. And unfortunately that journey can be very difficult sometimes. And yeah, but so I guess that was our very joint long-winded answer. Hashtag bend and CRISPR, whatever. Anywho, now we're going to get into more specifics about grad school itself. And then I figured once we were done with the questions that I have specifically, we can just very quickly walk through, like, how do you literally become a genetic counselor? Like, what do you have to do? So, anyway, grad, Was there anything that was completely different than you expected, especially given you worked for a genetic testing company prior to going to grad school?
I think that, and this might just be my own personality trait, but I had a lot of self-doubt going into it because I had taken some time off of school. There was about 5 years in between when I left undergrad and when I was starting grad school. And so I just thought that I would know nothing and that I would have such a hard time getting back into the swing of things because mm-hmm. I had been kind of rusty. But obviously my experience working at a genetic testing company was pretty valuable, and I learned a lot about really specific areas of genetics that none of my classmates had. So that was really nice and kind of surprising that I actually did know a lot going in. But I think that I was expecting it to be a lot harder just to be a student again. But then I had to remind myself, the first time I was a student, I was taking classes that like I sort of cared about. And then when you go into genetic counseling programs, hopefully you have an interest in genetic counseling. And so you are learning about all the things that are going to get you to that point. And hopefully you're then more interested in the classes and you perform better because you're actually interested in the material you're learning. And I don't know why that was like such a hard concept for me to grasp that I would actually enjoy class. But I think just in the past, I had been like kind of a shitty student.
Ditto. Yeah, no, I was very concerned that I wasn't going to even be considered anywhere because my GPA wasn't fantastic leaving college. I think something to really point out about the graduate programs for genetic counseling is the interviews are really important because that's where the program directors or whoever's doing the interviews really gets a taste of why you're there and the passion that you have for this specific thing that you want to do. And that speaks far more volumes than like, you know, only okay GPA. Like, of course, if you have like a 3.8 GPA and, you know, you have a stellar resume and all the things, like, that's really great. But, you know, if you walk into the interview and you're like, oh, I'm here because I want to make lots of money, like that's not going to work.
Yeah. Really. And I had a less than stellar GPA. And I, like you, actually applied twice for genetic counseling school. And, mm-hmm. you know, that second time around, I had so much experience that the GPA really just didn't matter. They could tell that I wasn't like a complete idiot because I had taken the GREs and, you know how to math and write and things like that. But I think that, you know, a well-rounded person is going to look good on an application. And you're right, that interview is the most important part. And they say that it's the hardest part about becoming a genetic counselor is just getting into a program.
Yeah. And I think even now, like I would say definitely, especially a couple years ago, but even still now, even though there's more programs that are opening, there's only so many slots. And there's a lot of people who, now that this field is more recognizable, genuinely do want to go into it. But we're still in a place where there's probably too many bodies and not enough spots. So you have to really differentiate yeah. yourself going into, you know, the whole interview process. Obviously you probably remember me telling you like every day, like you know so much already, like your first like semester is probably going to be like, I know this and whatever. But even beyond that, like a good thing to point out is there's a lot more people, you know, who are in still the typical age bracket for going to a program, but maybe they took off a couple years. Like my husband Arthur is turning 35 at the end of this week, and he's in grad school now. But, you know, he worked for a while in the profession that he's getting his master's for. And, you know, there were still things for him to learn in grad school, but he already had a grasp on the many large topics or concepts that came up in the program itself, for him, it being
social work. Honestly, it's something that I would highly recommend. I think there are a lot of people that go into school. I mean, I'm in a class of 16. I don't know if you talked about like class sizes, but that's huge for genetic counseling programs. Four to eight people. So with 16 mm-hmm. of us, I think five people had come directly out of undergrad. So they were ages like 22, 23. There was, maybe another eight or so that had been working for 1 or 2 years. And then only a few that had been, I'm the oldest of my class at age 30, and, you know, had been out for 5 or so years. And I think that the people that have had outside experience are more likely to do well, not only because they have maybe some experience working in the field of genetics, either as a GCA or at a lab, or even just having research experience, but having that professional experience, I think, is really valuable in knowing just like kind of life skills.
Right. And yes, life skills, I think, are something that are far more important when you're going into a medical professional mm-hmm. role of any type, because you are going to inevitably be interacting with other parts of a care team. And that's going to include nurses and doctors and even just clinic staff, like the front desk lady or, you know, man or person. We don't gender stereotype here. But those are all going to be potentially very powerful personalities. And you're going to have to know how to navigate the terrain of that while also sticking up for yourself and being able to say, like, I hear what you're saying, but this is why XYZ needs to happen.
And like with undergrad, like, you know, your hand is held a lot, whether it's by your professors, yes. like your academic advisor, your parents, you know, your hand is held a lot. And then in grad school, at least in my program, it's extremely supportive. And, you know, once you're in, you're in. And they're going to do everything in their power to help you succeed, but not without you putting effort in.
Well, right. And I would say that's probably because that's the same experience I had at Sarah Lawrence, where it's like, you know, like, amazing, you made it here. Like, that's fantastic. We exalt you and support you, but also the sink or swim portion of this is on you. Like, that's on you. And I remember, like, in our first year, like, we had a couple classmates that ended up dropping out because they went through, you know, the first semester of classes or even like the first two semester of classes. And if by the end of the first semester, definitely by the end of the first year, like, if this is not for you, there's going to be some alarms blaring, yeah. like, this is not for me. And there were some students that just, you know, weren't really up to snuff. They weren't great with, you know, studying skills or with papers or things like that. And I remember the program director being very honest and open with all of us about the fact that if something comes up where there needs to be a discussion, it's going to happen. And it's likely going to be something that may mean you're not going to see a classmate anymore or things along those lines. So it's really, it's basically training for real life, mm-hmm. ultimately. But going back to what you said about, you know, there's a lot of people in programs now that were out of school for even just a couple of years, maybe, but, you know, they worked as genetic counseling assistants or, you know, they worked at a lab as some type of liaison or things like that. Roles where you don't have to be a genetic counselor, but you're in the field already. I think that's a really great tip. Like if you're not sure, or if you apply and don't get in, that is 100% not the end of the world. But if you come back with something like being a genetic counseling assistant, or, you know, at Cooper Surgical, there's a couple people in our client services team right now, even that their goal is to go to grad school to become a genetic counselor, but, you know, they're working directly with the genetic counselors every day as a scheduler, or, you know, working with patient files and the organizing of all that stuff and things along those lines. That is all going to look amazing on a resume, but also don't be bashful or scared to talk about that experience in your interview, because if you can say you already have experience with, you know, the idea of the patient care team and genetic counseling, and you've observed genetic counselors doing what they do, and you know about XYZ disease and all those things, those are, you know, skills that you've already built that the program's not going to be worried about building for you. And you're going to look better than, you know, that person that might be coming right out of undergrad. Without like
11 out of 16, yeah. I guess, that had work experience of some kind and were not coming straight from school. So, you know, if that shows you what programs are looking for, just in the numbers, if you're coming right from school, you've got to have a really great resume and really great experience.
Yes. And I don't. Yeah. And I'm just like, how? How did that happen?
I did not have time for that in undergrad. I was being a bum.
Correct. I was eating egg sandwiches and probably watching a lot of daytime talk shows. That's, yeah. Okay, so a couple more questions. Moving on to internships. Internships are a very big portion of your education in grad school, not just for genetic counseling, mm-hmm. but again, other medical professions as well, like speech pathology, social work. My husband is still dealing with his internship right now, even though we're all on lockdown and he can't actually do his internship. I don't know what's going on with you, if you're like done with your internships or not. Yeah, I could only imagine. But what was the most valuable lesson you learned from your internship experiences?
So at Arcadia, you do, in your first year, you have three what they call practica, and they're shorter, more observational internships where you're really just supposed mm-hmm. to go in and like see how it's done. And then in yeah. your second year, you do four full internships. You have to go for 20 days. You're accumulating your core cases so you can graduate. And on my very first practica rotation first year, I realized very quickly that I had been pretty self-sufficient working. I had done research for myself. When I had to answer a question, I relied on my own abilities a lot and didn't do a whole lot of asking for help or asking questions. And that was one thing that I found really valuable as a student again, is reminding myself that asking questions doesn't make you look stupid. It makes you look interested.
Oh, yeah.
And that's really what your supervisors of your internships want to see. They want to see that you're like asking questions and interested in what's going on. And I think that was one of the biggest lessons I learned, is that even though I may have had some like social anxiety around that or whatever it was, that when I started asking questions, even if it was something I maybe should have known the answer to, I was able to show my supervisor that I like wanted to be there and I cared and I wanted to learn.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. And, you know, I don't really supervise students directly anymore for more than one reason, because hashtag Corona, but also, you know, as I've talked about a little bit, and maybe I'll talk about more at some point, like my current genetic counseling role is pretty non-typical, and I do more laboratory operations and actually talking to patients or students. But when I did work in clinical care, one of the things, back up though, not the first time around, not with like Jenna, but with like interns after her, after I actually knew what the heck was going on and what I was doing and what I should be doing as a supervisor. One of the first things I would tell interns on their first day is that there are absolutely no stupid questions, and it doesn't matter how ridiculous or small you feel a question is. It's better to ask it than to try to figure out the answer yourself by like skimming along with me and then getting more confused. So that's a really great point. And the other thing is, I think it's a really good point to say that I think in today's day and age, it makes me sound really freaking old, but you know, with kids growing up with the internet and having a smartphone and basically having, you know, like this computer and the encyclopedia of Google right at their fingertips, it's a lot easier for someone to get into the habit of just Googling something than asking a question to a real life person.
Yeah, and I think it goes back to the conversation we were having about like med students, how like, oh, it just sounds like you Googled that disease and looked up the genetics home reference page. And
right.
If you're asking your supervisor, exactly, you're going to get an answer that involves actual experience and patient emotions, and those add this whole another level to whatever you're doing.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Like, it's not just an answer. It's an answer colored with information that's going to be super valuable to you as somebody else who is, you know, gearing up to do this themselves. Just ask questions. Questions aren't stupid. It's also not stupid to feel your emotions. Like, that's really good to do. That does not really completely relate to what we were talking about, but just a PSA, apparently. Feel your emotions.
Okay, that is the end of part one of our conversation with Casey Marks on how to become a genetic counselor. Now, if you still have burning questions that haven't been covered yet, please don't fret. We have more colorful conversation and lots of useful advice coming up in part two of our conversation. Either than that, that is all for now. I will probably be releasing part two before the week is out. I don't want to put too much space between the two parts. Until then, stay happy, stay sane in this quarantine. And as usual, if you have questions about specific diseases or other topics that you feel like you would like to hear me talk about and cover on the podcast, please let me know. You can get a hold of me at our email address, genetherapypodcast@gmail.com. That's genetherapypodcast@gmail.com. Or you can slide into my DMs on Instagram or a new development on Twitter. On both Instagram and Twitter, my handle is @genetherapypod, all one word. That's @genetherapypod. Now, either than that, my name is Nick Charles, and this has been Gene Therapy. Goodbye.
This has been Gene Therapy with Nick Charles. Please note that while I am a medical professional, any information discussed in this podcast does not constitute actionable medical advice. If you feel genetic counseling is appropriate for you, visit nsgc.org to find a genetic counselor practicing in your area. And don't forget to comment, rate, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Bye for now.